A congressional race that's come down to a handful of ballots. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The District 20 race to replace Alcee Hastings is so close, only a few votes separates the two top candidates. More military and overseas votes are coming in later this week, but what happens if we have a tie? Also, Miami-Dade has a plan to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2030. A look at the region's plans for the climate crisis. And then finally,
it doesn't matter what tia or tio or grandma or grandpa say. Close your eyes and just do what works for you and your family.
Two South Florida moms host a podcast to share their experiences of caring for children with autism. We introduce you to the Disorderly Blondes. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, votes are still being counted in Broward and Palm Beach counties to see who will move forward in a congressional race. Two candidates vying to be the Democratic representative for Florida's 20th congressional district are still just a handful of votes away from each other. It's a race that's been rapidly changing. Now, that seat represents majority black areas of Broward and Palm Beach counties. Joining me now to talk about this, WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Danny, I was following the drama, by the way, on you and one other person's Twitter. And if you don't think you can have drama on Twitter, no, there is. First of all, remind us who the two candidates.
Right. So the two candidates that are the top tier candidates where this battle is really between them, one is Sheila Sherfalis McCormick, a Haitian-American from Miramar. She's ran for this seat twice before against late Congressman Alcee Hastings before he passed earlier this year. So she's been trying to get into this slot for quite some time. She's very progressive in a lot of ways. She supports a Green New Deal, a lot of social spending. So she's one candidate. She's self-made healthcare executive. On the other side, we have Dale Holness, who's a Broward County Commissioner, long timer in Broward politics, was the mayor of Broward County, was very close with Congressman Alcee Hastings before he passed, and basically says that he got the congressman's endorsement, and actually Alcee Hastings' son at some point did endorse Dale Holness, so he's kind of running as continuing that legacy.
All right, so the race was down to a few votes in it, and I was following again. It was changing. It was like 3 votes, 5 votes, 12 votes, and it was just, you know, and then more votes are coming in. So you were there Friday. What was the drama? What was going on?
Right. So, you know, it's Florida. I've covered a lot of recounts at this point, and, you know, a lot of times, like, you show up and kind of roll your eyes like, okay, we're doing the recount, but there's 10,000 votes separating the candidates and you're kind of just going through the motions of it. This was not that. You know, when we started the day on Friday, there were 3 votes separating these candidates with Sherfalis McCormick on top. And you're going over just a couple of ballots and seeing, are we going to count this one? Are we not going to count that one? So it actually, at one point, they took 1 vote away from Sherfalis from McCormick. So it went down to a 2-vote spread. And then they went through the recount, and they took 1 ballot away because they said it had a weird marking on it, but they decided to actually include it. So then by the end of the day, she actually went up 1 vote. And the same thing happened in Palm Beach County, where I was not. But at the end of the day, she was 5 votes ahead. So it could have gone easily the other way, but now she's 5 votes ahead.
By the way, I mean, Holness was there.
Both of them were there.
They were both there on Friday.
They were both there. They were sitting just a few feet away from each other. I saw them give a kind of awkward, hi, hello.
What are they doing while they're there? By the way, that's not unusual, right?
Right, 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 right.
But what were they doing that while they were there? Just, I mean, you know, was there any conversation at all?
I did not really see them talk with each other besides that one kind of awkward hello. But Dale Holness actually was very involved in this because there was a... You know, there's mail-in ballots, and there was a lot of mail-in ballots, and there was a certain number of them, a couple dozen, that were rejected from the canvassing board. And that was because they didn't have a signature, because the signature didn't match. The voter changed their party registration before voting. So he was actually right there standing at the table, and I was right next to him questioning these ballots, trying to get those ballots counted, because in Broward County, that's his stronghold. He did very poorly in Palm Beach.
And it was a low voter turnout anyway, but do we have a sense of how many votes have been counted?
I don't have the exact number right now, but it's about 45,000 total between both counties.
And again, it's come down to just a few. Still, some more votes are being counted this week. And those are coming from where?
Right. So in most elections, these votes are kind of afterthoughts. You know, someone concedes, someone claims victory, and, you know, it's just like a formality. But the votes that are left to be counted are overseas votes. So that's actually any military votes, any American citizen from the district who's living in France, say, or the Netherlands, whatever. Those people have the ability to send votes in, and they can still reach the supervisor of elections office by this Friday. As long as they're postmarked before election day, they will still count. So there's a handful of these ballots that have not been counted yet, and because it's so tight, that could determine the whole thing.
Because as you said, in most cases, in other races, it's thousands of votes difference between candidates, and a few votes coming in wouldn't make a difference. It's going to make a difference probably in this one. And that's not, by the way, just to remind you, there's no fraud. Nothing's going on. This is normal. People can send in their ballots overseas as long as it's postmarked, as you said.
Right. I mean, but what normally happens, even in very tight races, is that someone reads the writing on the wall, they do the math, and they say, okay, I'm going to win this race, so I'm going to declare it a victory. And then the opponent usually will concede. They'll say,
right,
okay, yeah, okay, I lost. You know, I can't overcome that odds. With this case, like,
it's a few
it
votes.
Could happen.
It's a handful of votes. Again, talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, talking about that Congressional District 20 race right now that is so close, again, within a handful of votes, between Sherfalus McCormick and Holness. And you know what? Follow this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Danny's going to be reporting on it. Danny, what happens if there's a tie? And it could happen because it's so close. What if there's a tie? How do they figure this out?
Okay, so I have never seen this happen in Florida election. I know it happened a couple years back in a state House of Delegates race in Virginia. It's in the Constitution. They will have to draw lots. Ask me what that is. I don't even know. I was just Googling it. I was just YouTubing, like, actually trying to find what that looks like. I will say I was just laughing to myself because there was a case in 2006, which was not election related, but basically a federal judge in the Orlando area, to settle a dispute between people where there was like no resolution, he made a court order that they had to draw lots and essentially wrote, you have to meet at this place and this time and play a game of rock, paper, scissors. And that will decide the race. That will decide the dispute. So we're actually realistically staring at the potential of something being decided by a game of rock, paper, scissors here, or maybe they come up with a different kind of game of chance. But that it could happen. Like, this is not just a hypothetical. This is a little bit more than hypothetical. It could happen.
I mean, I've heard in some cases they draw cards. Sometimes, you know, you maybe two best out of three or something like that. But okay, all right. Well, hopefully that doesn't. I mean, it makes for an interesting story.
Rock always wins. I mean.
I'm not laughing because it's just the absurdity is what I'm laughing at. Is it because it's sad that an election would come down to something like that? There's another part of the story that's interesting, though. We're talking about the Democrats, but on the Republican side, the primary winner is someone by the name of Jason Mariner. He's a convicted felon, and he's been very open about this story. Who is this guy?
Right. Mariner is he's taken up the mantle of basically a Trumpian Republican, America First. He's very against vaccine mandates, school mask mandates. He's very much kind of going for the libertarian bent of the Republican Party in the Trumpist fashion, I guess I would say. He won the primary pretty handily. But what has happened is that he was always transparent about the fact that he is somewhat of a reformed person. He used to get in a lot of trouble And then now he's kind of more or less seen the light, and he's straight and narrow. He's going to run for office. The problem with it is he has felonies on his record. And Governor DeSantis and the cabinet earlier this year actually just changed the rules of clemency so that people like him will be able to run for office if they have nonviolent convictions, which it doesn't look like any of his convictions are nonviolent. But you have to apply to the state to get your right to run for office back. And he never did that. He never submitted the paperwork. But at this point, he won the Republican primary. So people will likely be casting votes for him. And he's actually not even eligible to hold that job.
He's not eligible to hold the job. He probably isn't even eligible to vote, probably, right? Do we know that?
Well, that would depend on if he's paid his fines and fees and anything related to his court case. But that's one thing. That's automatic. But for regaining your right to hold public office, you have to write something and actually apply to the state, and they will grant it.
How did he get this far? How is this not vetted, you know, by Florida Secretary of State's office?
It's not the first time something like this happens. Like there is not vetting that the state necessarily does on the front end, or cities that they do on the front end.
Like to get my name on the ballot, don't I have to go through a process and then they check me to make sure that I can even be running?
Not really.
Wow.
And the same thing. And you know, like I was going to say, for the same thing for cities. We just had someone in a run for mayor of Miami who couldn't prove that she lived in Miami. She was not eligible. People were voting for her. There was someone a couple years ago in the city of Ocala who won a city commission race, who, same thing as Mariner, never got his right to hold public office back. So they had to actually just hold another election because he won the election. He couldn't actually take that seat. So it's not unprecedented, but for a congressional race, Yeah.
But, you know, this, I mean, as we've said, this is, you know, this is a seat that's been held by Democrats, and he may get some votes, but
right.
There's no way in the world.
I mean, realistically, just the partisan makeup of this seat, I don't know the exact odds, but, you know, 100-1 odds that this is going to go to a Democrat. So the likelihood of, you know, him winning the race and then having to figure out what to do with his eligibility, it's probably not going to happen.
Right. But if he did, I mean, it would be the typical Florida story, of course.
On top of the rock, paper, scissors potential.
Of course. Oh. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, follow this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Danny, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to meet two mothers who decided to share the challenges of raising children on the autism spectrum. They're doing it in a podcast. But first, emissions, heat, and Glasgow. Do Miami's climate goals add up? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. World leaders are wrapping up the climate conference in Glasgow. Some of the people who are in attendance include Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava and Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. Now, Miami-Dade has a plan to reach net zero emissions within a decade, but there's a lot of questions as to whether or not it'll work. And how much of the work is going to be cutting emissions, or is it just us adapting to the changes that are already taking place? Well, joining us now to discuss that and issues like raising streets and a new thing called a heat season is Miami Herald environment reporter Alex Harris. Alex, always great to have you.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, let me start with COP26. That's the climate change conference in Glasgow. Some of our leaders were there, both Miami mayors. What role do they play in that? Because, I mean, you're talking about presidents of nations. What are the mayors doing?
Right. So COP26, giant, global, big wigs, all talking about climate action. But there was actually a lot of stuff happening on the side, a lot of smaller conferences. So we saw both of our mayors were there, sort of, it seems like a lot of networking, sometimes speaking on panels. We saw a little bit of news from Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava at one panel, nothing yet from Mayor Francis Suarez. they both mentioned that they might bring back some policy that they'd heard at some of these meetings, but you know, they're not necessarily taking part in some of the negotiations or anything like that.
Yeah. I wonder, how does the world look at Miami? Because, I mean, different people have said it, like, we're the canary in the coal mine, right? When it comes to sea level rise, if you want to know how it's going to play out, just look at Miami. But does the world see that? Do they look at us that way?
I think Miami holds a very special place in the global eye. We are a place that is a canary in the coal mine that gets used a lot, but we have so much money at such a high level of risk that is unlike a lot of other places around the world. We're not necessarily the first city that's going to experience a lot of high tides and floods. Some of the lower island nations in the world are probably going to experience that first, but we have billions and billions, trillions of dollars of real estate that are all at risk. And so a lot of people look to Miami as being one of the high net worth cities that, our adaptation is sort of the leading the way for everyone else to see how do they do it? What can we learn from them? And if they can save Miami, then we can save other places.
So let's take a look at some of the things that are changing here in South Florida. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava talking about during the climate conference that Miami is going to now have a heat season. Now, we're not talking about the basketball team. Heat season, which is a weather season, is about how hot it gets here. And it kind of runs almost the same time that hurricane season does, sort of. But what is this heat season thing? What are we talking about?
Right. So I think hurricane season is a really good parallel. So Mayor Levine-Cava announced that starting next year, from May 1st to October 31st, Miami-Dade County would announce a heat season. And just like hurricane season, the magic number does not hold all hurricanes within its boundaries. You can have storms before, you can have storms after. It's just sort of a meteorological signifier of this is when most concentrated activity happens, and such with heat. It's hot all year round here. But that 6-month period is really, really hot. It is, you're likely to see health effects. You're likely to see physical effects on the environment around you with that level of heat. And so the Miami-Dade County is hoping to use that as an opportunity to educate people on how you can stay cool and healthy and safe and not get hurt in that extreme heat.
And one of the things that you reported on is that the county will try to make available maybe some shelter for people, especially people who are experiencing homelessness, to get out of the heat. Is that right?
So that is, that's something Daniela Levine-Cava mentioned on her panel at COP26. We're going to open shelters to anyone who needs them to stay safe from heat. But when I pressed her and the chief heat officer of Miami-Dade County, Jane Gilbert, on that question, they mentioned that, the answers weren't really there. They weren't even sure which exact shelters they were going to open. They don't know what the rules are for who can stay, how long they can stay, what threshold you have to meet to be able to stay, like how hot does it have to be? And they hope to flesh all of that out in a series of workshops and meetings in the next couple of months, hopefully before heat season gets started. But the answer to that is we don't really know what exactly is going to, what that mean when they say they're going to open heat shelters.
I wonder right now, how many days out of the year does South Florida, Miami specifically, experience these hot days where it feels the temperature never rises into the hundreds, but because of humidity, we feel like it's in the hundreds, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's called a feels like temperature, where the combination of heat and humidity crosses over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's pretty dangerous for health. It's hard to do even yard work or construction work outside in that level of heat. And right now we get about 41 days a year in Miami-Dade County, according to a study by the Union of Concerned Scientists, where it's that hot or feels like it's that hot.
So about a little over a month every year, we feel that kind of heat. But if things keep going the way they're going, science says it's going to be a lot. We're going to have a lot of days in the coming decades where it's going to feel that hot.
Right. By 2050, if, they call it a business as usual, so it means carbon emissions aren't curbed, they keep rising dramatically. The same study by the Union of Concerned Scientists found that could rise to, Miami-Dade specifically, 134 days of the year.
So we go from, that's like basically 6 weeks
quadrupling
to over 4 months. Oh, my God. Okay. Because a moment ago you talked about health risks, with heat. And what are some of the ones that people could experience that are really dangerous?
Right. So heat is not great for the human body. Extreme heat isn't great for the human body. We need to cool off at night to make our systems work better. And as the nights are getting hotter, which they are in Miami-Dade, your body cannot properly cool down. And when it's really hot, you can have things like kidney issues. We've seen farm workers down here in South Dade experiencing extreme kidney issues from the extreme heat and not being hydrated. It can affect heart and it can complicate heart and lung issues you already have. And there's even some studies showing that it can complicate mental health. If you're experiencing a mental health crisis, the heat can trigger one, it can make it worse. There's all these different side effects the way heat affects the body. And there's a huge body of physicians down here calling for climate action specifically because they see that risk and they know it's only going to grow if we don't curb emissions.
And you know, I wonder, does any other city, any other country in the world have a heat season? Are we first?
So I asked the Arch Center for Resilience, which is where they worked with the county to come up with this heat season concept. And they seem confident that Miami-Dade County is the first, but I do also have done some research and found that United Arab Emirates, where Dubai is, they have a season of the year, about 3 months of the year when it gets really hot outside, that they ban all outdoor work during the hottest hours of the day. So if you run a construction company, you got to go early in the morning, late in the evening, just to keep people safe. And that is a federal, that is a national mandated law that you can get fined, you can get in trouble if you're caught with a construction crew out in the hottest part of the day. And of course, in United Arab Emirates, it's more than 100 every single day. It is scorching outside. So sometimes heat scientists point to their role and say that other governments may have to look forward to that. So maybe we're seeing a little hint of that in what Miami-Dade County is proposing for next year.
You know, and I think about heat, and I mean, I've lived here in Miami now for 7 years, but before that I was in Las Vegas. And I know that people say dry heat, but I'm going to tell you something. I experienced 115 degree temperatures, and yeah, it's dry, but it's horrible. It still hurts.
It's because your body can't regulate with sweat. If it's too humid outside, you get to a point where your body cannot naturally cool off with sweat because it's so humid. And that is why the feels like temperature is so dangerous in places in the South, like Louisiana and Florida and Texas. When you have that humidity, it's just a double whammy compared to just the dry heat.
We're talking with environment reporter Alex Harris of the Miami Herald, looking at a number of issues here. We got a heat season to start next year, and we're going to look at some other issues here. Follow all of her reporting, by the way, on this, and also the, you know, our mayors in Glasgow on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Some really fascinating things that they've been doing over there in the big climate conference. You know, I wanted to ask you about one of the big challenges. You know, for this, the climate issue in Miami-Dade is we have a climate plan, and it's supposed to help cut emissions by at least half by 2030 and completely by 2050, but it may not actually work. That's what I was reading, and so I'm wondering, wait a minute, why do we have a plan then? But help me understand what the plan is. How are we cutting emissions?
Right. So Miami-Dade County just released right before COP26 got started its new climate action strategy. And this is a draft we saw on Earth Day this year, and they went around to have a lot of public meetings and ask for people's input on what kind of action should we take as a community to make sure we can meet those goals. And the idea of half emissions by 2030 and zero by 2050 lines up with what we've heard from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of this will help us mitigate the worst of climate change. We'll still see sea rise, we'll still see extreme heat, but we'll see a manageable amount and there'll be a lot fewer deaths. So for Miami-Dade, they said, okay, great, here's the things we're gonna do. We're gonna put more electric cars, we're gonna encourage more electric cars, we're gonna transition the public fleet of cop cars and buses and trolleys to electric vehicles as fast as we can. We're going to encourage more people to use public transit. We're gonna expand solar power. But even all of those strategies will not get the county to half of its emissions by 2030. There's still a 30% gap.
So the plan is cut it in half, but they can't get to that by the end of this decade. I was looking at the report that you had posted. One of the things, I didn't realize this, you know, when you look at transportation, air travel, it makes up a quarter of the emissions of the county. How exactly could they cut that?
So yeah, air travel is super interesting. And part of it, when I talked to Chief Resilience Officer for Miami-Dade County, James Murley, he explained to me that that's because when an airplane fuels up at a place, that destination gets credit for all of the fuel they put into the plane. Or same with cruise ships. And planes are notoriously high carbon. There's a whole movement in Europe that Greta Thunberg started, leads sort of convincing people not to fly and to try to use trains or public transit to get where they need to go, because planes just eat up a ton of energy and they spit out a ton of planet warming gases. The answer to that, of how we're going to cut that, is very complicated. We don't really know yet. The technology is not quite there. Miami-Dade has talked a little bit about some strategies to better technology to help planes land better and take off faster, so you're not sitting in the plane idling, which I think passengers probably would appreciate too. And there's small changes you can make to be slightly more efficient, but really what we need is to come up with a renewable or alternative energy source to use to power airplanes. And that technology is still at least a couple of decades off based on what we know right now.
Yeah, and of course the other one you mentioned too a moment ago is more solar energy. And Florida, you know, we're the Sunshine State. We're not even leading the country in solar energy. But why is that? How do they plan on doing it?
So the county has talked a lot about its plans for solar, and they've done some interesting things. They've put there's a new plan to put solar on one of their affordable housing buildings for seniors. And that not only does it, you know, cut down on the emissions we're producing, but it also makes the place safer. So you don't end up what happened after Hurricane Irma, where the poor people in those affordable senior living housing in Hollywood sweltered to death in the heat. If you have backup power in case of an emergency, it's more resilient for a community as a whole and not just cutting down your emissions. But solar is tough, right? We rely on a power grid powered by Florida Power and Light that runs about 60-70% on natural gas. We have about 20-ish percent of our power comes from nuclear. And right now in Miami-Dade, it's less than 6% of our energy comes from solar. Now, Miami-Dade has talked about installing enough solar in the next decade to power 110,000 homes, which is a ton of solar. But that would still only get us to about 17% of our energy from solar. And that's because there's only so much you can put on top of buildings and private homes and county buildings. What you really need is massive scale solar plants, which FPL is building, but they don't have plans to necessarily meet the goals that Miami-Dade or other cities across the state or country or nation are looking for when it comes to reaching those goals of using more clean and renewable energy.
So much sun and we're not taking advantage of it. I'd propose, if they really want an idea, cover all the parking lots. We have a lot of parking lots. Cover them with solar panels. I don't know, but I'm not the guy for the, you know, that has the answers. I wanted to get to this with you before we finish up, is because one of the challenges that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, cutting emissions, mitigation, and adaptation. And so part of what we have to do is we have to adapt. We're going to adapt to rising seas and rising temperatures. And this has been going on in Miami Beach. They're raising roads. They've been raising some roads, and they have a pump system. That's angered some people, and now there are lawsuits. Lawsuits against raising certain roads, because if you raise certain places, the water just flows to the low-lying areas. What are the laws? Who's suing the city on this?
Right, so we've seen the first couple of these lawsuits that the city has, residents have been talking about ever since the city first proposed elevating roads and using a pump system to keep those roads dry in the face of stronger rainstorms, higher tides, all of what have you, from everything from climate change. So we saw a couple lawsuits. One was filed this August, and it was two property management companies who run some Airbnbs in South Beach, sort of near Lincoln Road. And they said that when the city raised the roads and added the pump stations, they now raised the roads above the height of the properties, which traditionally drained into the street. And now they say that that water is draining onto their property and into their home. So they've sued the city, and they want a couple of things. They want the city to recognize that flooding. They want to see it as a takings claim in legalese. And they also want the city to allow them to grandfather in to continue running Airbnbs out of their properties, even though it's not allowed in that area anymore.
I mean, what is the plan for Miami Beach officials to raise all the roads? I mean, don't we have to basically raise the whole city?
If that's what logic might tell you, is that if the water's coming up, you also have to come up as well. And there are plans to elevate buildings as well. I think we're really relying a lot in mainland Miami-Dade on potential federal money from the Army Corps plan to elevate, you know, fire stations, hospitals, private homes, that sort of stuff. In Miami Beach right now, they're doing what they have the right to do, which is public spaces like roads. Elevating public property is really expensive. City can't necessarily do it themselves. They can go out for grant money to do it. They can find federal cash to encourage. They can encourage people to do it. They can change the codes to make it easier. But that has not really been a huge push from the city of Miami Beach, is encouraging private homeowners to elevate their homes yet.
Do we know, by the way, how many roads in Miami Beach have been raised?
It's hard to keep exact track of it. They raised a bunch for a few years, and then they stopped 2 or 3 years ago. There was a call for like a pause. They called it the Great Pause in Miami Beach, and they hired some expert teams to come in and review the city's adaptation plan because of things like complaints that raising roads would flood properties. And in response to those, the red team that came in and analyzed the city's adaptation plan and those complaints, the city has increased its outreach and marketing and communications to residents to explain what's happening. And they've made a couple of tweaks to make sure that, you know, when they raise the roads, water doesn't end up on people's property. They've done some drains on individual properties in Palm and Hibiscus Islands, although that led to a whole issue with Miami-Dade because they didn't get the proper permits, a whole other thing. But yes, it's a really adaptation is really complicated, and we're learning a lot from Miami Beach because they're one of the first ones to do it.
And wasn't one of the complaints too when they raised the roads that the pump system didn't work as it was sold to us?
There are a lot of complications with the pump stations. When they first talked about designing them, residents spoke up and said, you know, the whole extra generator adding is gigantic, it's unsightly, it's loud, and it's potentially smelly. So they've said, you know what, just hook it up to power, it'll be fine, we don't need that, we need a lower profile pump. But of course, Tropical Storm Emily came by a few years ago and the power was knocked out and therefore knocked out the pumps. So the roads continued to flood. And businesses nearby continue to flood, even in areas like Sunset Harbor, where they already raised the roads. So now the city has moved forward to say that, okay, all additional pump stations we build will have generators, will have backup power. And they've made a lot of adaptations based on how people actually use the products they're building and how they work or don't work in individual neighborhoods.
Oh, so many things that we have to plan for and prepare for. And as you said, it's because we have such expensive real estate here that, it, you know, when it hits us, it's going to hit hard. Alex Harris, environment reporter for the Miami Herald. Follow her reporting on all three of these stories and more. We've got links on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Alex, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye.
And by the way, you can stay in touch with us via our text club, because I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You know, one question I have is, at what point do you decide it's just not worth living here anymore? I know some people, they'll stay here till the day they die, but, you know, those floodwaters are coming. The water is coming. The weather is going to keep getting worse. At what point do you say, maybe South Florida ain't worth it? You know, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Text us the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. And by the way, just think about the other day. We had a couple of days of rain. Just rain. It wasn't even a hurricane. And I mean, people were flooded in their homes. They were stuck in their homes. They couldn't get out. Just something to think about. Still to come, two moms who laugh together and share their experiences raising sons with autism on their podcast, Disorderly Blondes. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, I remember some 30 years ago when my cousin Nico was diagnosed with autism. Everyone in the family dealt with this diagnosis very, very differently. It wasn't easy. Every year, one in 54 children is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. Years ago, it happened to Brenda Propitskin and Christy Venata's children, and the two moms didn't even know each other at the time. But they quickly became friends, and they decided that the challenges of raising children with autism was something that not enough people were talking about. So they started a podcast called Disorderly Blondes. Yes, they're both blonde-haired women, of course. The podcast tackles the tough questions that mothers in this situation have to deal with, but it also allows them to let their hair down and discuss the other things in life, just to remind us that life doesn't stop. We spoke with Brenda and Christy recently about the podcast, and we started by asking what it was like the day that they got their children's diagnosis. I wanted to know about the day you got the diagnosis, and when that happened, what's going through your mind, and what did you understand about what that meant? Tell me about that day.
Whew. Wow, I'm sweating already. I cried a lot, and I don't even know what I was crying about because you really can't wrap your mind around a diagnosis sometimes. And again, this was 14 years ago. It was a different time. There wasn't a lot of information out there, or not a lot of networking. There was clinical information about autism, but there's not the networking and the Instagram and the mommy chats where, you know, people could get together and commiserate and share ideas. So, you know, it was an extremely confusing time. And I guess I cried because I didn't really know what I was dealing with or what his future would be like, and in perfect, you know, with perfect honesty, what, how that would affect me, my relationships, my life. So, you know, it was pretty tough. Talk specifically about that day. It's hard. A lot of loss.
Brenda, what about you?
The appointment was about an hour away from home. And I 45 minutes away from home. And I drove home just numb in silence, not understanding what just happened, even though I was fully expecting it. And we had a terrible experience with the neurologist. He was late. He never really said the words autism, but he did say I should call the CARD Center, which is the Center for Autism and Related Disabilities. And so I'm thinking, why do I need to call this place if he doesn't have autism? And it was just very confusing. But then on paper, he wrote diagnosis autism. So I just kept looking at that paper. What does that mean? And I just went into full damage control mode, like, not us, not my child. I am going to do everything possible to get him out of this. And, you know, I really thought back then that it was just like a couple of years of work and we would be not in this autism world. You know, back then he was 3 when he officially got the diagnosis. He's 19 now. So clearly I was very wrong and I've learned a lot during this journey. But I just went into mommy mode as like, not me, you know, here I come, like, get out of my way. I mean, I'm still like that. And he's doing great because of that. But I was just in like fight mode and let's go. Bring on the challenge. I got this. And then, of course, I cried. and cried. And I might still be crying because I'm a big crier, but yeah.
Wow. I've read the story of how the two of you met, and I wanted to hear from you, though. Brenda, I think it started with you, right? So, I mean, here you are. I think you were at the school, right, in the car waiting to pick up your children, and you saw Christy. You didn't know her, right? What happened? Tell me the story.
So I was in a really dark place and it was around diagnosis time. And I was in a really dark place in my life. I had other personal issues going on and I was just, you know, I was depressed. I was really depressed. And here's this bubbly, pretty girl who every single day would park right in front of me for carpool. Well, both of our kids happened to be in the same elementary school. So Dylan would have been 5, right? And JR would have been 3, or pre-K. And you know, every day I would just look at her, and then she had Jackson, the baby, in her arms, and we had been trying for baby number 2. And I remember just looking at her, look at her. She's perfect. She must have the perfect life. She has the kiddo who's coming in all happy from school. She has the baby in her arms. She's fit. She's happy. She's just absolutely flawless and perfect. And then fast forward to someone mutually introducing us and saying, you know, it's a very normal thing in our autism world for parents to recommend, hey, you need to talk to this mom because she's going through what you're going through. And someone had recommended that I speak to Christy, and I was just so annoyed. I didn't know who Christy was when they recommended her. And make a very long story short, I went to her house, and when she opened the door, it was the girl from carpool. And I was like, oh my God, no. Like, I thought she was, I mean, she's still pretty perfect, but you know, I was happy and I was sad. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. We're in the same club, but hey, you're my new bestie. Yeah. And that's it.
Christy, what was your impression of Brenda when she told you that story? What'd you think?
I remember calling her because, you know, I don't know who had whose number first, but we were talking on the phone and I introduced myself. I said, hi, I'm Christy, your new best friend. And I could, like, I think I could like hear the eye roll. I know she was thinking, A, I don't need any more friends. And B, who is this girl? And C, I'm chasing my autistic child who's like 10, you know, 1,000 feet ahead of me in the park. I'm sweating, I'm so annoyed. And we just, you know, it started from there. And we did become best friends from that day.
But that's so fantastic that, you know, you see each other not even realizing, and then you end up coming together as friends. And I'm wondering, at what point did you decide, and where did the idea for a podcast come from?
I had just recently done an interview on TV for a Latin news local channel. And I don't know, Christy and I are usually really artistic and we come up with all these ideas. And of course, right away when I finished that interview, I had a feeling. I said, you know, we need to do something like this, a local program where parents can just listen to us, because this is what happens in real life. Like I said, parents just suggest you need to go speak to this person. And since our kids are older, we have a lot more experience, or we're ahead of this autism thing, right? And we say the same things time and time again to new parents that we meet. And I just said, why don't we, it's one of those things where I started the sentence and then she finished it. She already knew where I was going with it before I even finished. And like a week later, we had the logo, we had the branding, we had the idea, we started recording. We just work really well together. And it just happened very, very, very quickly.
Going through the podcast, and you're now, it's four seasons, you have over 100 episodes. You talk to different specialists and different experts on things. And I'm wondering, as a parent, is that information out there? You said that, you know, that clinically you can find information, but, you know, the support and the information necessary, is it easy to access?
I think, you know, everyone can Google. But for us, at least in the beginning, when we were bringing on guests, these were people that we had relationships with, that, you know, they met the disorderly tribe stamp of approval. They were, you know, practitioners we had used for years and years and really clicked with, and we would have them talk about the pros and the cons of, you know, of different, therapies and this and that. But really, for us, we thought it was such a bonus because, you know, number one, we could speak really off the cuff, you know, with some of these people. And that's what listeners really need to hear, like the casualness of it. Instead of saying, oh my gosh, you know, I'm really trying to find an OT. So I'm going to look up, you know, the OT. I'm going to try to correspond with my insurance. Then I'm going to go interview all of these, you know, individuals. What is OT, by the way? What does it even stand for? So Here we are breaking it down, explaining all the acronyms. And even if, let's say, that listener doesn't use that particular person, it's not really a promo for that person or that practitioner. It's a promo for the therapy or, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. That person's talking about. So we're really just trying to save time and effort and take the burden off the parents.
We're talking with Brenda Propitskin and Christy Venata. They are two South Florida mothers who started a podcast a few years ago called Disorderly Blondes. It's a podcast where they talk about what it's like to raise children with autism. And you can find out more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. One of the other things that I really found so fascinating about your podcast is you have these conversations about something so serious and something that could be very emotional, but that the two of you find the lighter side and that you can still laugh and enjoy. And you talk about how to enjoy your life. How do you find that balance?
One of the big things is bringing in these families into our lives, so to speak, because we do share a lot on, we share so much about our lives with everyone. And one of the things was, you might listen initially to the podcast and hear a lot of giggling and Spanglish and joking, but at the end of the episode, you will stop and say, oh, wait, I actually learned something while I laughed. And that's just, we really are, like she said, we're unfiltered, we're off the cuff. We just kind of roll with it. And that has been one of our strengths, I think. It's just to be able to do it all and keep it light. I think there has only been one episode that was very, very serious, which is not like us at all. but we also talk about, we have an episode series, which usually airs at the end of the year, which is the papis. And that's when we bring in the dads and, you know, they have their own ideas and that is always one of the most high performing episodes because everyone wants to listen to their opinion and their jokes and our interaction together. And then that also, we talk about what we do individually as couples, whether we go to dinner or how we spend our time. And yes, we do reinforce the need for me time and couple time because you cannot, like Christy always says, you can't pour from an empty cup. You have to just have some kind of balance and some kind of fulfillment, even if it's an hour to read or anything, just You need to find that me time and that couple time so that we can be strong for our children and just be better parents all around.
You know, Christy, I was thinking about, you know, the fact that both of you now, your sons are older teenagers. They're growing up. And you've talked about this in the podcast, but what, you know, what's that conversation like right now as you think about your sons becoming men and what kind of care and support they're going to need?
That's a tough one. The short answer is there's nothing. So parents, prepare yourselves. Statistically, you know, you add it up, the services are all, and yeah, thank goodness for early intervention, but the services are all for or geared toward younger people on the spectrum. There's very, very little out there after high school, after 21. It's very, very sad. Brent and I are both lucky that we are in communities that are really on it. And we report progress in that area all the time. But it is so difficult as a parent to think, wow, how am I going to afford this therapy and that and all of these things throughout the years? And then save to take care of your child for the rest of your life. And what happens after I'm gone? Like all the feels. Even if my child can work, he's not going to have meaningful employment. He's not going to be able to support himself. So, you know, going back to what Brenda said about, you know, trying to enjoy your life, enjoy your husband, live every day. Do I not go out and enjoy myself because I have to save every penny because my child, you know, after I'm gone, he's going to be destitute? Or, you know, finding that balance is really, really hard. But again, short answer, there's not a lot.
I wanted to ask both of you this as we finish up here is how often you run into people in situations where folks don't understand what's going on and then maybe they say something or come up to you and ask you something that's inappropriate or it's uncomfortable, but it's because they don't know, it's uncomfortable for them, but they don't understand and you wish they did. Brenda, what about you? Is there, because this may be good advice for folks if they happen to see a family in a store, you know, before you go talk to them, realize there might be more going on than you think.
Yes. You know, I tend to roll my eyes sometimes during April, for example, when there's all this focus on awareness and then everyone takes off the blue shirt and forgets about all of that awareness in April for the rest of the year. And our big thing is, you know what? Autism is 24/7. And while we appreciate the support and the awareness of April, it needs to really be about action for the rest of the year. And part of that action is being aware that autism exists. And unfortunately, as you say, sometimes people do say or do the wrong thing. I had a very good friend years ago when Dylan was little say to me, you know what, Brenda? She's like, you're so lucky. She said, when Dylan goes to college, you're never going to have to worry about him being out drinking or having anyone calling you about this. And I'm thinking, I want to get called that he was doing a keg at a party.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry. I mean, I don't care if he's a C student. Like, how do you say that to me? Like when when we're thinking, and look, Dylan's 19, he's not in college. You know, all of my friends right now, their kids are with the acceptance letters. And so that's very, very hurtful, even though she is the sweetest friend. And I know she didn't mean it in a bad way, but wow, at that time when I was depressed, did that hurt?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, so a
lot of that happens if you see a child having behavior or a child being inappropriately close, you know, no personal space in a store, or something called stimming, which is stimming presents differently. It could be physical, things like typical, you would say like flapping hands, but it could also be like vocal tics. So you might see a child screaming or repeating or having a grunt or something that's clearly odd and stands out. Just, I would say, like, to do your best to not stare or eye roll or, you know, oh, you're so inconvenienced, you know, because this child is grunting. You know, get over it. Clearly something's going on. Have some compassion and patience and just do anything possible to make that parent and that child feel comfortable.
Yeah. I, full disclosure, you know, this has affected my family. I have my aunt has a son who's severely autistic and he's now in his 30s though. But I remember when, you know, he was being diagnosed and how difficult it was for the family, everybody reacted differently and we couldn't come together on this. It's just because everybody was in a different place. And I wanted to know, for those parents that are going through that moment right now, what do you say to them? What's the advice you give them? Where can they turn?
Something we always say on the podcast, which is do you, because it doesn't matter what Dia or Dio or grandma or grandpa say, it does matter. Just thank them, smile, and then just do you. Because at the end of the day, it becomes really overwhelming when everyone has an opinion about anything, the food they eat, a therapy. So just close your eyes and just at the end of the day, just do what works for you and your family. And then tune into the Sterling Bonds. Yes.
You know what? I got to tell you something, and I definitely would recommend that. I think what the two of you are doing is fantastic. Brenda, thank you so, so much for what you do, and thanks for sharing the stories with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. This is fun.
And again, that's Brenda Propitskin and Christy Venata, hosts of the podcast Disorderly Blondes. Find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I highly recommend it. Well, that's our program for this Monday, November 8th. Coming up, we want to ask you, parents, if you're considering getting your kids vaccinated. And if you have any questions, we're collecting those now. Text us 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. We're going to share those questions with an expert soon about child vaccinations. Thanks again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Stay safe. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.